David Malouf is one of our best-loved Australian writers. In part, this is due to the intimacy of his writing and its imaginative qualities, the sense that he is first and foremost a poet in his perceptions. There is also his curiosity and his wide-ranging knowledge, which is evident not only in the historical settings of his novels, but in the scope of his writing, in essays, short stories, libretti, reviews, and drama. David Malouf's most familiar works are the novels Jono, An Imaginary Life, Fly Away Peter, which is often studied in high schools, Harlan's Half Acre, The Great World, Remembering Babylon, and his most recent novella, really, Priam. There's his collection of autobiographical essays, 12 Edmundston Street, and his 1998 Boyer lectures, The Spirit of Play. His earlier poems are included in the collection Selected Poems 1959 to 1989. His more recent poetry collections are Typewriter Music, Earth Hour, An Open Book, and the selection Revolving Days. I spoke to David Malouf about his body of work, from the 1960s as a poet and from the 1970s as a novelist, his career as a writer, the time he spent away from Australia in Italy, his international reputation, and the imaginative power of his writing in Sydney in April 2021. David, we've known each other for a long time, over 40 years. I suppose this conversation of necessity is a retrospective one, retrospective looking. I guess the first question I wanted to ask you was how you thought of your role as a writer, how it had changed or evolved over the years. Because when I first met you, it was soon after the publication of An Imaginary Life, so pretty much at the beginning of your career as a novelist.
Well, it's not, that wasn't quite the beginning of my period as a novelist, because I a book I'd been writing for something like 10 years, which was Jono, was published in 1975, but written in 1972. So that's really 4 or 5 years before An Imaginary Life. And of course, I'd been publishing poetry since 1962. I think, like other writers, you know, when you begin, you have no idea of what your writing life is going to be. I mean, you hope that you're going to have one, but you simply start doing whatever you can do. And I think, in some ways, one of the determining factors in your life as a writer is how quickly you realize what your voice might be, what the scope of your writing might be, if you have an opportunity to, you know, fulfill that scope. And I think that changes your notion of whatever you're doing in the meantime. And I think what that I mean by that is that after a certain point, certain number of poems, certainly a first novel, you begin to think that what you're producing is a body of work, and you commit yourself to whatever that body of work might be. And I think when you do that, you're becoming a serious writer.
But there's a number of factors involved in thinking of your writing as constituting a body of work. First of all, a certain degree of receptivity amongst the readers that you're writing for. I mean, if there's no response at all, it's going to be hard to maintain the idea of creating an oeuvre, a body of work.
Look, I think it is difficult, but I think it really has a lot more to do with your notion of yourself than with the receptivity of readers.
But there is another factor too, and I think that's ambition. To what extent do you have an ambition to be a writer? That's very strong these days. I think writers often put the ambition before the writing in some respects. That is, they have a notion of writing as a career. But in your days, in the 60s particularly, when you started out, I think the idea of an ambition was less formed, perhaps?
I don't think you had any idea of an ambition to be a writer, because there was really not much prospect of that. And I think really that all of that depends literally on yourself, on what the opening up of your writing tells you about what you could possibly write if the conditions are right. I mean, I think I had a great many very, very fortunate moves. And some of that was recognizing them and taking advantage of them. But I think it was a particular moment, and I was very, very fortunate. That means that when I published Jono, I had no idea of how that book might be received. And you're right, it surprised me. I mean, I had signed a contract with UQP that they would not produce the paperback because I wanted the paperback to be something other than, you know, the usual UQP paperback. And at first, it was refused. The first reading, when it came back from Penguin, was that this was a nice little book which would interest a few Queenslanders but would have no other interest to people.
Well, that's what I mean, you know. I mean, forming yourself as a writer and an ambition as a writer in that context, you know, a small book from Queensland that might be of limited appeal, or even more, you know, an immigrant writer with a funny name. I mean, wasn't it difficult to construe yourself as a writer in those circumstances?
I didn't think of it that way. I was prepared to believe, because that was a first novel, and because I'd taken a very, very long time to write any prose that I thought was publishable. I mean, and that was more than 10 years after I began publishing as a poet. And I think, you know, finding a voice in prose was much more difficult. I was then very surprised by the way that book took off, and that it did become not only read Australia-wide, but I mean, it was very, very well taken up in the States, for example. After that, I realized that the most difficult book for any fiction writer is the second book. And I was very, very lucky because I sat down and wrote very quickly, in just 6 weeks or so, a book that I didn't know was my second novel. I mean, I had no idea what it was. I thought it was a long prose poem or whatever. I also realized that because it had no Australian subject and perhaps no interest to Australian readers, that there was no place here for it to be published. And then quite by accident, it fell into the hands of someone who took it to America, and it was published there.
Who was that someone?
An Australian poet was visiting Australia. That American was Mark poet. Strand.
Yeah.
And at a dinner party at my place where they were, Bruce Beaver, in talking to Mark Strand's wife, talked about the manuscript. And when she was leaving, she said, you know, he was being told about this manuscript, I'd love to read it. And I said, oh, sure. So I gave it to her to read. And then about 6 weeks later, she rang up and said, look, I didn't say to you at the time, but I actually work for a New York publisher, and I'm sure we would be interested in this. And I'm at the airport now. Can I take the manuscript with me? And that's how that happened. I mean, just a sheer accident.
So it was taken up first in America and then in Australia, is that right? And do you think the fact that it was to be published in America influenced the decision to publish it here?
It was published in America in 1978 or 9, and then was picked up by an English publisher, three English publishers through my agent. I then got an agent in them because I was now an international published writer. And three English publishers bid for the book, and I went with Chatto, and it was then published by Chatto in London as an English publication, and that's the way it came to Australia. And I remained with Chatto,
yes,
and all my books until Chatto was taken over by Knopf.
And do you remember the Australian reception of An Imaginary Life?
Oh, well, the Australian reception was very easy because the book had had rave reviews
overseas
in New York,
yes, yeah.
and it also had very, very, very good reviews in England. So
yes.
It was a kind of established book. So when it came to Australia, it was easy. But I'm not sure, but I would have thought that was one of the very, very, very first novels by an Australian published in Australia that had no really Australian subject, although I noticed that, you know, later and even now, more and more people keep reading that book.
Yes. I want to come back to An Imaginary Life. I mean, reading it again recently, it just struck me what an extraordinary work it was in relation to the prevailing atmosphere in Australian literature and in Australian fiction. So perhaps it needed that overseas interest in order to get it going here.
Yeah.
Because it's just remarkable, quite revolutionary in terms of not only being set in a remote place, but more particularly its language. It's a poetic novel. It's an extraordinary thing for a novel to be poetry, virtually.
Yes, that's one of the reasons why I'd found it easy to write my second novel. That I thought, too, that I was writing, as I said, a monologue, a prose poem.
Exactly.
The interesting thing is that it came at a moment, too, when people overseas were starting to think about the new thinking about the writing back from the empire sort of thing. And so it was seen as a book that was doing something I had never heard of.
A post-colonial.
Post-colonialism, yes, exactly.
The
whole business of being at the centre or at the edge.
Yes.
And that really became something that people became interested in my work, an aspect of the work, which was that conversation between the centre and the edge.
I just want to go step back one step to look, because you were a poet before you were a novelist, and so you were recognized as a poet. And so in a sense, your sense of yourself as a writer was formed in the first instance by your sense of yourself as a poet. And in that respect, you were part of a community, and you were an activist as well, both politically and in literary terms. So surely that must have had a strong bearing on your sense of identity as a writer anyway.
Yeah, I think I was not very aware of that.
Really?
I mean, you can be all of that and be, you know, in the middle of it without exactly being aware of it. I mean, I think that I've almost always, in a kind of way, been concerned with my own problems before asking myself how general they are or what they represent out there. But I mean, there are a whole lot of ways in which that book got written.
Which book?
An Imaginary Life. And after it came out, first of all, there were all the people who took it up as an example of phenomenology.
Yes.
And the French were very interested in all of that. And then there were the people who took it up as a post-colonial novel, and the other people were interested in that. A lot of people were interested in it in terms of the notion of language and poetry, and that had to do with a lot of stuff at the time that was,
and there was the French, the French obsession with the Foundling, and the Wild Boy of Aviron.
Sure,
came out around
all of those things
too, yes,
had got into the book, without my saying to myself, I'm putting them there, or they are things which are alive out there in the literary world as arguments or as interests and things. And so the book really kind of... It developed a character out in the world that I had not necessarily determined for it, but it meant that I was responsive to all of those things without knowing exactly very much about them. I mean, I knew nothing about phenomenology or the kinds of arguments about a new language that I was writing about.
But, you know, you're very well read. I mean, I think that's one of the features of your standing as a writer is how broad your knowledge is. That's particularly obvious in the reviews and in, you know, the public engagements you have, you know, the Boyer lectures and so on, where, you know, the full range of your reading in history and philosophy, like in one of the essays, you know, you quote Condorcet. I thought that was not on everybody's tongue. So it's not as if you were as unaware as you're claiming, really.
Well, I'm not really claiming to be unaware. What happens is, I think, that when you sit down to write, you have to let fall out of your head almost everything you know consciously, so that the writing can take place. And I think I became quite
early... But you're
early.
Talking about a certain kind of writing. That's the novel writing or the poetry. Because with the essays, it's very
they're,
much
they're
in
different.
Your head.
They're different. Yeah. And I would make a distinction there between the way your mind works when you're writing discursive prose that calls on everything you know, and what happens when you're sitting down to write a poem or a book like An Imaginary Life, when... you really want to say, I know nothing. Please tell me something. And that's what the book or the voice or whatever it is supposed to do for you.
And tell me, did the reception of An Imaginary Life have an effect on you, a sense of what you could do as a writer or to what you might aspire to?
Yeah, look, the moment that book came out, and certainly its reception in the States, made me see that I could, in fact, become a full-time writer. And I would have to become a full-time writer if everything I thought I could do was going to get done. And that was the point at which I decided to give up teaching at university and to take the risk. And that's when I left Australia and went to Italy and settled. And that was a very, very conscious choice, because one of the things that was happening was everybody now over my shoulder here was telling me what I could do and what I couldn't do.
And what did they want you to do?
Oh, there were all sorts of questions about what kind of writer you thought you were and what you were capable of and what you weren't capable of. And I wanted to get away entirely from all of those people watching over my shoulder. So that meant leaving the country. And I could have gone back to England, where I'd lived for 10 years and was very happy. But all that meant was that I would fall into another literary world where I... people would be again telling me what I could do and what I couldn't do. So I chose absolutely to go to a place that was not an English-speaking place, but where I felt very comfortable and where I could simply ignore all those voices. And it was a bit difficult because I think I moved on from there to Child's Play and Flyaway Peter, two very, very different books.
Yeah.
And I'd had a book in between that I thought I was writing and which I abandoned.
Which one, where was that set?
That was a book that, I mean, I was interested in it, but when I got about halfway through, I realized that this was could be a good book. But it was not one of my books. I didn't want it to be one of my books. And it was a book that was about young Werther. And the last page of the book was the first page of Goethe's Young Werther. And I thought that was, in the end, just all too clever and too much part of the fashion there to be a book that I wanted to be one of my books.
Too much part of the fashion where in Europe, you mean?
Well, in the literary world, yes. For, you know, books of that kind, really, they were sort of playful meta-novels that I didn't want to go with.
I just wondered if you could be more specific about those voices that were telling you what you could and couldn't do. How constricting were they? Or how censorious? I mean, after all, you had made a great success, both of Jono and An Imaginary Life, so why were they telling you what you could and couldn't do?
Well, Jono came out to an absolutely hostile reception. Almost all the reviews were bad.
Really?
Yeah. There were two good reviews, one by David Robotham in Brisbane, who, of course, was interested in the extent to which that was a Brisbane novel, and a very, very good review from Anne Summers in Adelaide, which, just responded to the book. But all of the rest of them were really saying things, look, you know, you're a poet, why do you think you can write a novel? And you know, there was a review by Douglas Stewart that took that kind of attitude, and I think there were two extremely hostile reviews. One in Nation Review, where I was also a reviewer, by John Tittensaw, and another very, very hostile one by Kynaston. I forget now what his first name was.
Edward Kynaston.
Yeah. And, you know, he actually said, this is one of the worst novels I've ever read. And it's an example exactly of the way editing and publishing in Australia gets away with things that you could not get away with anywhere else in the world.
So basically they were trying to put you back in your box.
That's right, as a poet.
Yeah.
And then, of course, An Imaginary Life too. There were people who responded to that negatively. They thought it was precious and, again, of no interest really to most people, readers in Australia. And I thought, I'm not going to sit and listen to this every time I take up my pen, remember what all of these people are looking right over my shoulder about to say.
So presumably the voices have gone away now, or at what point did they go away?
No, I don't think they ever go away, but you become much more resistant to their influence on you.
Yes.
You know, what you say to yourself, I think, is quite true. If you're going to believe the people who have positive responses to this, you have also to believe in the people who have negative responses, and that's what it'll always be like. There will be, you can't please everybody, and if you are pleasing everybody, you ought to start worrying.
So, but moving to Campagnatico did not mean abandoning Australian subject matter or Australian settings, because there was Fly Away Peter, And Remembering Babylon, Conversations at Curlew Creek, The Great World.
Yeah.
So, if anything, Australia presented itself even more intensely from that perspective, from that overseas perspective, and historically as well, because each of those novels was a historical novel.
Yeah, I didn't ever become, you know, in the usual sense, an expatriate, because I had no fixed abode in Campagnatico. I came back to Australia usually for 2 months every year that I was there. So I was just somebody who was going away quietly to a retreat and working away. And, you know, I didn't have a telephone there. I didn't have a car. So it was a lonely place to be, but it was a good place for writing.
But you've also always been very social, so there was a milieu as well. There were people visiting Robert Brain's opera events at the nearby monastery and so on. So it was quite a fruitful intellectual milieu as well.
Oh, yeah, I had a lot of visitors there.
Yeah.
And also, of course, I did have ties to London, old ties, and new ones. And what also happened, and I think that was enormously important, is I really became part of the kind of international world of publishing then. You know, I mean, I went to the poetry festival with Struga. I went almost every year to Harbourfront in Canada, which was at that point the great meeting place for international poets and novelists. And I really, you know, I must admit, I got to know almost everybody writing in my generation there. That was a great thing to be able to do.
And an extraordinary thing too. And so that's why I keep coming back to this idea of your sense of yourself as a writer, because at that point it had expanded in range far beyond what you could have imagined, I guess, in your early days in Brisbane, which you know, you were essentially a provincial poet and active. You know, I remember, and then at Sydney University, I remember the Vietnam demonstrations and the Vietnam publications, and then your role at UQP in the paperback poet. So you were very, very active, but it was in a very circumscribed
Well, that way. International world, I think, which is very, very important to a writer, that's where you learn, recognize who your peers are, and you know, that kind of makes you more ambitious.
Well, that's the word I was looking for.
Yeah, it makes you more ambitious, more aware of what you might take on. I don't think I've ever actually been very competitive. That's not what I mean. But I mean, you realize what the possibilities are, and you feel you should write to try and fulfill them.
So it's ambition in terms of your writing, rather than in terms of your own personal standing.
Yeah. Yes.
And do you think that did have a decisive effect on your writing?
Yeah, I think it
on your later works?
Yes, absolutely.
Which ones would you see as kind of more cosmopolitan or more
Well, it's not actually being cosmopolitan. It's being taking on some wider perception or wider notion of what the world is. And I think that that's certainly true of the great world. It's certainly true of Remembering Babylon. It was also, I think, true of a book which I've always been fond of, but which I think has fallen out of people's memory quite a lot, and that's Harlan's Half Acre.
Why do you see those three books, or Harlan's Half Acre in particular, as more ambitious in terms of the writing?
They're about different things. Harlan's Half Acre was about what it is to be an artist, and in Australian terms, it's about something that interested me a lot at that moment, and that is the notion of possession. So it actually took up the colonial notion in a kind of way, and it was about the difference between possessing the place legally and as a piece of property, and possessing it as part of your consciousness.
Your imagination.
The imagination. Yeah. And it was kind of the imagination, the occupation of the place through the imagination, and that still seems to me to be a very, very important subject.
Yes, for you, absolutely central, I would have thought. That's why I mentioned the word imagination, because that's not a concept that's very popular at the moment, but it's you've always been a champion of the imagination.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. And that's that. In each case, too, I mean, it was also true of Flyaway Peter, because that book really was about the birds, and the birds were an example of migrants who come and go and who are capable of existing in both hemispheres at the same moment. And so that was the original subject of that book. And at first it was a long short story, and it was when I'd finished all that part of it that I said to myself, actually, I have to make the central character here do what the birds have done and go to the other part of the world. And that was the involvement then with the First World War. And, you know, that book, as I say, would want to say is a kind of double subject. One is the idea of the birds and the sanctuary and the fact that, as I say, they managed to live in two hemispheres, and what happens to us when we're forced to live the same kind of life, to go to another hemisphere. And so, I mean, that's what gives that book its kind of reverberations, I think.
Was that written in Campagnatico when you were living in another hemisphere?
So yes, it was. And it was written also in a way which I then discovered was, for me, a very useful way of writing. And that is to write the book and then afterwards do the research that makes the book settle down into a world of facts.
Which involves a lot of rewriting? Or just,
not a lot. It involved getting hold of a very good book on birds and migration, so that all of that was right.
Right.
And then when I came back to Australia, I wrote the book quite quickly again, came back to Brisbane and went to the RSL in Brisbane and said, look, I've written a book about a guy who goes to the First World War and he's in one of the Queensland regiments, either the 19th or 20th Regiment. Do you have a history of either of those regiments? And they had a history of one of them. And I was then able to go to that and I was able to say exactly what the weather was like on each day of a certain thing and what the precise route was and all the buildings you passed in getting from the front line at Armentières, you know, into the actual trenches. So all of that, which is the research, was done afterwards.
Right.
And, you know, I mean, I learned then, which I already kind of knew, was that the thing about writing about something which requires research, if you do the research before, you find 5,000 facts that seem significant. If you do it afterwards, you find the 50 which are absolutely necessary to convincing the reader that the research has been done, but doesn't present them with research that really has nothing to do with them.
And the imagining, your imagining of the events in the First World War that were in the novel remained true.
Yes.
I mean, you didn't have to alter any of that. It was simply
providing what I had to do was supply enough facts to make people feel that they were accurately there.
Yeah.
But what belongs to the imagination precedes all of that.
Well, that's an important point, I think. Trusting the imagination.
Yeah.
Those books are also about families. Harlan's Half Acres, family, and even An Imaginary Life. Even though there's two main figures, the Ovid and the young boy. Nevertheless, they are a kind of father son.
Yeah.
So, but these are families, you know, formed by imagination as well. That is, by imaginative bonds or allegiances, or by election. You know. So it seems to me that imagination is crucial in just about every aspect of your writing.
Yeah, look, I actually think that what we discover through the imagination is as important as and has something like the same weight as what we discover through research, but also through working with facts, you know, whether you're an historian or a biographer or somebody who's exploring nature or whatever, that something about the way we think and the way we feel that belongs to another world than consciousness is very important. I mean, one of the things I actually say in the lecture is that one of the things that I think is most important to us is the education we get in forms of understanding and forms of feeling in the one third of our life that we spend asleep. So that dream world we're in those, that one third of the whole time that we're alive, That bears some very, very close relationship to the stories we tell and to how they work.
And one of your collections of stories actually has Dream in the title. But it seemed to me, I might be wrong, but that I didn't think dreams in themselves played a huge role in your writing, that the imagining is all out in the world, you know.
You're not
one of those Gothic writers that employs dream as a technique.
No, but I think dreams have their own momentum and their own way of relating one event to another.
Yes.
And that is something that belongs also to almost all the folk tales and fairy stories that we learn as children. And I think that they also provide the shape to a lot of the very best fiction.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that's what I mean, that in your writing, the dream is an active agency,
yeah,
which actually works in the world and on the world.
Yeah.
I'm thinking particularly in imaginary life, you know, where you present the theory of evolution really in imaginative terms, that is, in terms of a lower order,
sure,
imagining itself into a higher order and into a higher order all the way up to the gods.
Yeah.
And there's another part of an imaginary life which strikes me now in relation to COVID, and that is the description of the way the fever takes hold. It starts first in the foundling and then transfers itself to the son of the woman in whose house Ovid and the young boy are living. And you see that transmission of the disease or even the plague in terms of fear. That is, there is a physiological reason, but what really opens the victim to the plague or to the fever is fear. That is a quality of imagination.
Yeah.
So that's what I mean. It's not just something that's sequestered off. The dreaming is not something that's sequestered off in its own special reality.
No.
For you, the imagination actually works in reality as a formative creative principle.
Yes, but the mode of it is one that belongs to dreams, and that is that it's association. It works by association or by metaphor,
yes,
almost,
yes,
rather than logical progression.
And it might see, it often seizes on an object. I'm thinking of the pebbles at the end of, you know, an imaginary life, which become kind of like diamonds or just radiance. Often what the imagination unlocks in ordinary things is some kind of radiance or some kind of special power.
Well, I think that hanging on as a writer to what we learn from the logic of dreams is a very, very, very important part of what you have to give yourself up to when you're writing novels, certainly novels of a certain kind, and that's the kind that I write here.
And is that power still with you? What happens with age?
I think what happens to age is that a lot of the capacity for attention that you need, especially to writing a novel, goes.
Yes.
And I think that is the point at which you have to say, I could go on and write a novel now, but if it doesn't have the same kind of intensity as what I've already produced, all I'm doing is muddying the waters.
But the imagining, the source, I understand that the working requires more energy, which isn't available necessarily in the same concentration.
Yeah.
But the capacity for dream, which must be allied to memory in some respects, doesn't diminish with age, it increases.
No, I think that's right. But I mean, writing is a very, very particular activity. I mean, you have to be, especially if you're writing a novel, you have to do it every day and you have to do it regularly and you have to still be able to fall as quickly as possible into that half-conscious state in which the writing happens. And I think your capacity to do that diminishes. I mean, I see people who go on writing books, I think, well past the point where they should stop. And I, you know, what they're doing is really sticking to either a habit or an addiction, which they can't give up.
That's right.
Rather than saying, what accountability do I have to the books I've previously produced that what I'm doing now either adds to them or changes them in some way which is significant.
So you're still thinking in terms of a body of work.
Absolutely.
In that case. Yeah. For the future, I guess.
Well,
is that how you feel about it, that you've left a body of work that has the capacity to survive in its own
Well,
terms?
It's there. A writer has no control of that.
No.
The people who determine all of that are readers. Once readers stop reading your books, they've ceased to exist.
Well, that's not strictly true, because it doesn't require too many readers to keep a classic going, so long as it's there.
Yeah, that's Milton, fit audience, though few.
Yeah, exactly. It hasn't changed much.
No, that doesn't. But I think it's very difficult as a writer to say to yourself 98% of all the novels produced are never heard of again after then. Their first 5 or 10 years.
I think you can have greater certainty than that. But it's true, I think, that writing can be an addiction, so that you keep doing it. Even,
sure.
I mean, what else do you fill your day with and so on?
Yeah.
So how do you feel about that that waning of of energy? Are you happy to just take a back seat now for the books to make their own
absolutely,
way?
Absolutely, absolutely. And I don't feel any pressure to produce more than I have already done. No. I can't myself see what a book would be that would add something to what I've done. I mean, the last book of that kind really was Ransom.
Which was a remarkable book too, because it's a late book, but it's has all the power, imaginative power, and even a similar setting, a classical setting, that an imaginary life had. So there's no evidence of any waning there. There's a preoccupation, obviously, with age because of Priam. But it's a great book to have been the last of the novels, that's for sure. I remember you telling me once that you thought that your career as a writer had been sort of charted already with the first two novels. That is, that Jono was a great first novel, and rather than being a second novel, An Imaginary Life was like the last novel. I wonder if, and because of its subject, because it's an old man really heading towards death, it is fitting as a last novel. It does have that kind of appropriateness, even though it was written when you were a young man. Do you still hold that view, that An Imaginary Life is, in a sense, you know, the closing chapter?
Well, one of the things I kind of meant by that was that having written Jono, which is, you know, a book which kind of pretends to be a memoir and does that thing which I think most first novels do, draws very, very, very strongly on real happenings in your life when you're young. Often what that means is that after that, the writer has really nothing more to say. And, you know, they often go on writing more, but it doesn't matter. What I think I then did was leapt into a book which was pure invention. And to that extent, I would saying I had chosen, you know, I had in my first and second book gone from the beginning to the furthest you can go in your writing.
Yes.
And that the rest of what I wrote would somehow be filling in the space between, the world of interests between. And I think that's true. I mean, I think An Imaginary Life was, you know, the furthest away from Jono I could, in my conception of what I can do, could go. Mm. And the rest was a kind of filling in.
And what's remarkable is that it wasn't, by your own account, At any rate, wasn't the success of Jono that catapulted you into this exploration to the furthest reaches, really, of your capacity as a writer? On the contrary, it was a leap you made yourself.
Yeah. Look, I made that leap, and most of the writing I did afterwards depended on that leap. Hmm. There are a lot of people who I would say think that Jono was still the best book I ever wrote.
Jono or An Imaginary Life?
Jono.
In retrospect, they're saying that.
I think of a couple of local critics who recognise that as the book that they of mine that they value most. I think they're caught in the world of Australian writing, they say that this is a fully Australian book. I don't think they know what the others are. I mean, they don't quite know what to make of them.
I thought, to end our discussion, I would ask you to read a couple of poems. And Rapture, these are from the last collection, Earth Hour. And I think the first one, particularly Rapture, does remind me very much of An Imaginary Life, especially the closing pages of An Imaginary Life, which is a kind of rapture. And I think rapture, which is related to imagination, which we're talking, it's really imagination at its furthest extent in a way, really exhibits your power both as a writer and your capacity for imagination. But I just wanted, before we do that, I just wanted to make an observation. I don't know what you'd think of it, but it seems to me that this capacity for wonder, which is what it is really, comes out of your provincial background, you know, as a kid growing up in Brisbane, aware of the great world because it was all around you on account of the Second World War and the servicemen and all that kind of thing. But at the same time, you know, very much rooted in the place that in other circumstances people wouldn't be very much aware of. Do you see, because you have a metropolitan reach, you know, you have a cosmopolitan reach, but at the same time, so many of your books are rooted in the provinces, really.
Yeah, I myself am as much interested in the local as I am in the kind of great world that's out there. That has something to do with something I know I've said elsewhere, and that is that the most exotic place you will ever discover is the place you grew up in, because it's there that you were first aware of all the contradictions and the mysteries, the things that are hidden, the things that have to be discovered. And that first world you are in is a world you never quite leave behind.
You have it still.
Yeah, it's still the place that is most mysterious to you. Mm. I'm speaking of myself.
Yes, of course. But you still have it you. It's part of your imagining.
When I first went to Campagnatico, I knew nobody in that village. And I just happened then to meet somebody who became one of my closest friends of my life. She was an English woman who lived in the big house at Campagnatico, was married to an Italian, and we became very close. And the house she lived in was called Poggio Madonna.
Right.
And so this is a poem called Eternal Moment at Poggio Madonna. Miss Misha, in her cool reclusion, curls on the mat, has a feel for creaturely comforts, and has sniffed out this spot, though nothing in nature or that the eye can see marks it as special. The sort of animal warmth that a cat is drawn to in a cold house, as if the sun, centuries back, in a burst of candescence, had danced there, and the glow of its presence can still be felt. Or a young god happening by had stopped a moment to shake a pebble from his shoe, and found his soul struck by a mortal dweller of the place, and the bewilderment of instant attraction, eternal loss, still draws him back. Miss M has found it out. Basks in the sun's warmth even at midnight. Dreams of a cat that sleeps there inside the sleep of one who, without waking, from his tall cloud, leans godlike down and lovingly strokes her. This poem is called The Rapture, and it's the third part of a memorial poem for Joan Dessay, my Campagnatico friend. The being seized and taken, the being swept off your feet by your own breath, the moment and all time no longer on your hands. A lightning, as if in the nest of your palm, an egg, its shell as fragile and pale blue as the sky overhead, suddenly trembled and cracked open, as your self-containment might, and you staggered under the advent of wings. The loss of gravity, the weightlessness of being swept up and taken, less a breaking than a breaking out. This poem is called At Lerici, which is a small town in the north of Italy, and it's written for Carlo Olivieri, who's my 60-year-long best friend in Italy. He was partly responsible for my buying a house there rather than somewhere else when I decided to become a full-time writer. Darkly at anchor in the roadstead, ships keep close the secret of their journeys, and the islands theirs. History is made up of nights such as this, when little happens. Lovers in their beds whisper and touch. A new player tumbles onto the scene. Crickets strike up a riff on the razzle-dazzle of starlight, then stop. The blissful friction and pointless throb of night music is older, runs deeper than speech. An electric flicker, the planet's first incidence of traffic, then heartbeat, then thought. We sit in the warm dark, watching container ships ride on the blue-black moonlit glitters. After long journeying, arrived at the high tide of silence after talk.
David, thank you very much. The readings were wonderful. Thank you. I'm Ivor Indyk, and I've been speaking to David Malouf. This is one in a series of interviews that I've conducted with prominent Australian authors. I'd like to thank the Australia Council for their support in the production of these interviews.